Today is August 23rd, 2014. Okay, so we can begin with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we will be taking the Kaya Gata Sati Sutta. This is the discourse on mindfulness of the body, and it's sutta number 119 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so the sutta begins when a number of monks are sitting in the assembly, and then as they're sitting there, a discussion arises amongst them, and they begin to praise the Buddha for teaching the mindfulness of the body. And they say that it's wonderful, it's marvelous, how the Blessed One has said that mindfulness of the body, when developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and great benefit. Okay, as they're speaking in this way, the Buddha, this is sort of like a typical scene in the suttas where monks are having a discussion. they don't know that the Buddha is about to come to the hall where they're sitting and meeting. And then he's going to break into the discussion and ask them, what was your discussion that was interrupted? And sometimes the monks are a little embarrassed and they have to say, well, we were speaking about the baseball game or the football match or about this pop star or that pop star. And then the Buddha says, it is not fitting for you, it is not appropriate. Those of you who have gone forth from the household life into homelessness to be speaking about such a topic. But here, the monks are speaking about a suitable topic. But still, the Buddha asked them what was the subject of their discussion. And then the monks say that they were speaking about how it's wonderful that the Buddha has said that mindfulness of the body is of great fruit and great benefit. And so this provides the Buddha with the opening for beginning the discourse. And so he begins the discourse by raising the question, how is mindfulness of the body to be developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? And as we see that this kaya expression, kaya gata sati, corresponds very closely to the first foundation of mindfulness among the four satipatthanas. You know, the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body, which is called kai anupassana, which means contemplation or observation of the body. But here, basically, the same set of practices is grouped together under the expression kaya gata sati. So sati means, of course, mindfulness, and kaya means body, and gata means gone to. So it's literally, it's mindfulness gone to the body. But more freely, we could call it, or render this, mindfulness directed to the body, or mindfulness concerned with the body. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to expound mindfulness of the body, and he begins with a topic that should be familiar to us by now, since we just had the Anapanasati Sutta. So he begins with mindfulness of breathing. And so I'm not going to explain this meditation subject, because we just did it a couple of weeks ago. But we can notice here that because the Buddha is explaining mindfulness of the body, similarly to the Satipatthana Sutta, where he's explaining contemplation of the body, he only brings in here the first four phases of the full 16-phase process of mindfulness of in and out breathing. So this only goes from being aware of breathing in long, breathing out long, breathing in short, breathing out short, breathing in, breathing out, experiencing the whole body, and then breathing in, breathing out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. But here we come to a new passage, or a new little paragraph, which is unique to this sutta. It's not found in the Satipatthana Sutta. So here the Buddha says, as he abides thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions or thoughts based on the household life are abandoned, and with their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness. That's a little bit odd. Let's say unified, quieted, unified, and concentrated. That is how a monk develops mindfulness of the body. So we could see here two aspects, or two benefits of developing, in this case, mindfulness of the body as a form, mindfulness of breathing as a form of mindfulness of the body. First of all, one is able to get rid of what are called memories and, I would say, thoughts based on the household life. So this is why it would be particularly recommended to young monks, monks who have just recently gone forth, because when one has just gone forth, well, not only right after just going forth, but sometimes it happens 4 years, 5 years, 9 years, 10 years, that the mind will be flooded with thoughts about, you know, about the worldly life. And then if those thoughts become strong enough, then there comes a thought, let me give up the training and go back to the household life where I can do meritorious, where I can enjoy worldly pleasures and do meritorious deeds. And so to help overcome those thoughts, then mindfulness of the body is one of the methods that enable one to focus in on one's thoughts so that the thoughts don't have the chance to, you know, repeat themselves and develop and gain strength and then become overwhelming. So by continually bringing the mind back to the body, then it serves as a kind of backdrop for recognizing one's thoughts when they arise and then using the appropriate method for weakening and debilitating those thoughts. So they're both positive benefits, but in dealing with negative qualities, the mindfulness of the body helps in overcoming worldly thoughts and the longing to return to the enjoyments of the world. And even, I mean, it's useful not only for monastics in that respect, but for lay people who are practicing as well. You know, you might start to think, what is the use of this sitting here, practicing meditation? The mind is just wandering. And let me just give it up and go back to, you know, the ordinary way of living a worldly life. Just flow with the stream. You can say, okay, Bill Gates is a multimillionaire. Well, he's actually a billionaire. But you start thinking of millionaires who are enjoying yachts and homes in several countries. And you think, why shouldn't I just work harder, earn all that money, become a multimillionaire, and I can live in the same way instead of being content with a simple life and practicing meditation. Okay, so in dealing with the negative side, mindfulness of, in this case, mindfulness of breathing has this benefit. Then on the more positive side, through overcoming these thoughts, then the mind becomes steadied internally, quiets down, becomes unified and concentrated. And we see here, this is what strikes me, is that in this sutta on mindfulness of the body, at least in the initial part, the initial exposition, there tends to be more of an emphasis on samatha or samadhi, rather than in the Satipatthana Sutta, we have after the basic exposition of, say, mindfulness of breathing, then we go over to he dwells contemplating the body and the body internally, externally, internally and externally. He dwells contemplating the nature of arising, the nature of passing away. So there comes a switch over to vipassana or insight. But here, because of these words, steadying the mind, quieting it down, unifying it, concentrating it, the focus at this point is on strengthening samadhi or concentration. Okay, now we come to the second passage, and this is mindfulness of the postures, the positions of the body. And I think it's quite significant that, you see, the Buddha teaches mindfulness of the body and meditation in general, not just the practice that one does in the sitting posture when you have the eyes closed, the hands on the lap, but he sort of broadens the range, as we'll see, so that it comes to encompass all aspects of one's day-to-day life. And so here the Buddha is explaining that when walking, the monk understands, or he knows, I am walking. When standing, he understands, I am standing. When sitting, he knows, I am sitting. When lying down, he understands, I am lying down. Or however his body is disposed in any position, this he understands. Okay, so there's two ways in which one could undertake this practice. One is as a deliberate way, intentional way of practicing a meditation. And for this, the usual way is to use the process of walking as a kind of interval between periods of sitting meditation. So especially when doing a long-term retreat, in many meditation traditions, there'll be alternating periods of sitting meditation and walking meditation. And so when one is doing the walking meditation, in a general way, first one can be aware simply of walking back and forth. So when we'll choose an area, which could be usually 25, 30, 20, 25 paces, and then one will just walk back and forth, being mindful of the act of walking. But to help focus the mind on the act of walking, one will focus on each step. And so after getting accustomed just to walking back and forth mindfully, then in order to narrow down and to sort of focus the mindfulness, one will start to become aware of each step. So when taking a right step, one is aware of the right step. When taking the left step, aware of the left step. And in this way, one goes on right, left, right, left, right, left, till one comes to the end of the walking, of the walkway. Then one becomes aware of stopping, and then one pauses for a moment, and then one becomes aware of standing. So that fits into the scheme of the four postures. One is now aware of standing. Then one becomes aware of turning around. So that is not covered exactly by the four postures, but that would be however the body is disposed. Now it's in the act of turning. So one is aware of turning. Then one is facing back in the opposite direction. One pauses again and just stands there for a moment, aware of standing. And then one resumes walking, right step, left, right, left. But not like a military, a military battalion doing an exercise, right, left, right, left. Not like that. It's not mechanical or done to in an automatic, very it's not done in a mechanical way, but one has to walk at moderate pace, but being aware of each step. And that is the good way to practice for the purpose of developing or strengthening concentration. But when one is moving into the development of insight using walking meditation, at a certain point, once one gains the ability to clearly discern the distinction of right step, left step, then one could start dividing each step into three subordinate phases. So I found it useful to have them all labeled with a word that begins with P. So I have picking up, putting, pushing forward, putting down. So picking up, pushing forward, putting down, picking, pushing, putting. There are still further divisions of this up to I've learned it done with 12 divisions for each step, but we don't have to go into all of those. But when one is doing 12 divisions to each step, 12 phases, to walk from where I'm sitting here to the last table there, maybe a little further than the last table, could take 45 minutes to an hour. Normally it takes me about 25 minutes to walk a whole round of Duangyin Monastery. Okay, so that is the walking meditation. But also the sitting meditation can be done just as a meditation on the posture. It requires some degree of sensitivity, so it's not a beginning meditation subject. But after one has gained some focus of mind, for example, through mindfulness of breathing, then one could start, while sitting, just moving through the body, you know, taking different parts of the body, the head, neck, shoulders, and then going from each arm, the right arm, to the upper arm, lower arm, hand, then go down to the left upper arm, left lower arm, left hand, then come back to the neck, then come to the chest, abdomen, pubic area, the genitals, then come to the back to the upper neck, then come to the upper back, left and right, lower back, left and right, then come down to the buttocks, then go down right thigh, right lower leg, right ankle, right foot, then do the same thing with the left leg, all the way to the left foot, left toes, and then one keeps on scanning the body while sitting there. Then when one gets familiar with the whole body by scanning it, then one could just sit being aware of the body in the sitting position. And over time, as the mind becomes more and more sensitive, then one gets what I call this sort of totalistic perception of the body. The commentaries mention the case of some of the monks of old who had just practiced meditation in the standing position. But it seems if one does that too long, one gets really tired. And then the legs, I don't think it's such good for the legs. And then lying down is also a kind of meditation. If one gets tired from the practicing in the other positions, one could lie down. But there's a little risk with lying down to meditate, unless one really has to, because it's too easy to go into Mitya Samadhi, wrong concentration. And then you regain awareness, and then you start boasting that you went into the attainment of cessation or the formless formless meditative absorptions. Okay, and it's also interesting that the sutta mentions here, apart from the what are called the four main postures, it mentions that one is aware however the body is disposed. So, for example, if one is sitting down, as one is sort of partly sitting, you still maintain the mindfulness, though the body is not yet, it's no longer in the standing position, not yet in the sitting position, but it's in the act of sitting. And when one is standing up, one also is aware of standing up. As I mentioned before, when doing the walking meditation, when turning around, you're aware of turning around. When going to bed, when lying down, just as one is lifting up the legs and putting the body onto the bed, one still maintains the mindfulness. And so in this way, the mindfulness, ideally, it remains unbroken, uninterrupted. Okay, let me take the next section, then I'll see whether we have any questions. Okay, the next section, this is using Venerable Nyanamoli's original translation. He translated this, Sampajanya's full awareness. I don't quite like this because the word awareness is just, to me, it has so many meanings that it could represent many different words, many different shades of meaning. And so now I render sampajanya as clear comprehension. I've put the word on the board before, but I'll do it again. I'm not attached to this. Okay. Yeah, the Pali word is sampajanya. And now the word sampajanya, it's a noun, but it's based on the verb janati, which means to know. And so sampajanya involves a knowledge. And janya, which means knowing, is preceded by two prefixes, sam, which usually suggests either coming together or some kind of fullness or strength, extra strength, and pa, I don't know what it especially suggests, but putting them together to get the word sampajanya, I prefer to render it now clear comprehension. So it's a kind of comprehensive comprehension. Yeah, actually the word comprehension is good because it takes in two shades of meaning. One is inclusiveness and the other is understanding. And so you could see from the exposition of sampajanya here that it's inclusive because it applies to every aspect of one's activities, all the activities of one's ordinary day-to-day life, and yet it also involves some aspect of understanding, of knowing what is going on. So we just look at the passage and it goes, again, the monk is one who acts, here I would say, who acts with clear comprehension when going forward and returning. That is, when going out someplace and when coming back. He acts with clear comprehension when looking ahead and when looking away or to the side or looking back. He acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs. I think in ordinary American English we say when bending and stretching the limbs, the arms, especially the arms. Who acts in with clear comprehension when wearing his robes or putting on his clothes, whatever clothes you're wearing, and carrying the outer robe and the alms bowl. So this is referring to when the monk is going on alms round, when he formally puts on the robe and takes the alms bowl. He's clearly comprehends what he's doing. Who acts in with clear comprehension, even when eating, drinking, consuming food, we might say swallowing the food, and tasting the food. Who acts even with clear comprehension when going to the toilet, when defecating and urinating, and who acts with clear comprehension when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Okay, now clear comprehension seems to have different levels at which it can be applied, or different modes in which it can be applied. And to make this clear, the commentaries distinguish four aspects of clear comprehension. You know, I think this helps to bring out the meaning and to show how it's put into practice. Okay, the first aspect is what is called clear comprehension of purpose. And this means that before one undertakes an action, one should have a clear understanding what is the purpose of this action. And especially one has to evaluate the action to determine, is this really beneficial? Because the word atta here, which means purpose, also means good or benefit. So is the action that I'm going to undertake beneficial? And you could say that, you know, if we review our actions in the light of this criterion, you know, so many actions which are useless, harmful, frivolous, even self-destructive, we could eliminate. Particularly, like, people have a lot of bad habits, like, I don't want to be criticizing anybody, but smoking, drinking, chatting for long hours on the telephone. There's a kind of person, I don't know anybody here, Facebook addicts. No, really, there are some people. I mean, I'm on Facebook too, because I have to be because of Buddhist Global Relief. But I know people who just seem to spend hours, you know, with the most, and you look at the conversations on Facebook, often they're just so trivial. People spend hours and hours doing that. So if you investigate each action, is it really useful, beneficial for myself or others to do this? That provides a very helpful criterion for eliminating a lot of the useless actions from one's life. Separating the grain from the chaff of one's life. So the first aspect of clear comprehension is clear comprehension of the purpose by trying to determine whether the action one is contemplating is beneficial in terms, especially in terms of one's development in the Dharma, or useless and frivolous or harmful. Then the second type of clear comprehension is called clear comprehension of suitability, which means that one examines the means to determine whether the means is suitable for achieving one's purpose. So whether it's in a, maybe we could say, review, comprehending the suitability, maybe we could see two secondary aspects in this. One is whether the means is effective in achieving one's purpose. This is the pragmatic aspect. And then the second aspect is whether the means is morally appropriate for achieving one's purpose. This is the ethical aspect of the means. Because one might have a good purpose. Maybe one wants to gain wealth in order to be able to benefit others. But if one thinks to gain wealth by unscrupulous means, then one will be departing from the path of righteous behavior, the path of Dharma. Okay, the third aspect of clear comprehension, and this applies, the third and fourth aspects apply more particularly to the meditative context, and this is called Gotara Sampajanya, which means, or explained as, clear comprehension of the meditation object. So this means that one keeps the meditation object constantly in mind. And if the mind is straying from the meditation object, then one becomes aware that the mind is drifting, distracted, and one brings the mind back to the meditation object. So we see this aspect of clear comprehension even in the Satipatthana Sutta, under each meditation subject. For example, it's in the standard Satipatthana formula. you go to page 145, paragraph 3. Here we have the Satipatthana formula. So the text says that the monk abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware. That would actually be sampajano, which I would now translate clearly comprehending and mindful. And then that same expression comes with each of the four satipatthanas. So he abides contemplating feelings as feelings, clearly comprehending. He abides contemplating mind as mind, clearly comprehending. And he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, or dharmas as dharmas, clearly comprehending. So clear comprehension in this third sense, as clear comprehension of the domain of meditation, the meditation object. So that is what comes into play here. And then the fourth aspect of clear comprehension is called clear comprehension as non-delusion. And clear comprehension as non-delusion, this is asamoha sampajanya. This is where sampajanya, clear comprehension, starts to turn into panya or prajna, that is wisdom or insight. And in this phase, clear comprehension emerges from understanding that within all of these actions that are mentioned in this passage, there is no self that acts, but rather one is able to observe how each of these actions takes place through the interdependent, interconnected process or interplay of dharmas, of mere phenomena, selfless phenomena. For example, when one is walking forward, going forward, one comprehends that there's no self that walks. The act of walking is not originated through an I or a self, but rather the thought or intention arises, let me go forward. And then through the arising of that intention, then the bodily process is activated, which causes the legs to walk forward. And so one is aware that the act of going forward is an interdependent process of mental and physical phenomena working together. The intention of walking and the bodily act of walking. And so when walking forward, for example, one is able to observe the act of walking as this interplay of the intention of lifting the foot, putting it forward, then the physical action is the foot getting lifted and being brought forward. When one wants to look to the side, the intention arises, look to the side, and then the body follows the intention of looking to the side, and then an eye consciousness will arise, taking account of the object that is being seen on the side. And so in this way, there's this constant interdependent process, interwoven process of mental and material phenomena, but no self standing outside or within the process directing it. And so now one is comprehending the nature of nama-rupa, mental and material phenomena. And this can be applied to all of these actions that are described here. Okay, at this point we could see whether there's any questions. Heck, did you have a question? Okay. Okay.
On this last point that you made, what aspect of it is non-delusional? What aspect of it is
non-delusional? Okay. The delusion is like the ordinary thought of I am the one who walks forward. The act of going forward is directed by the I or the self. So the idea that there's some kind of truly existing I or self within, behind, above all of these activities, directing and controlling them. And so the investigation in terms of mental and material phenomena sort of dispels that delusion of the self. Donna?
Yes, actually, at the start when you, or earlier when you were saying the in the walking meditation, one proceeds from breaking up each movement from 3 to 12 or so, the thought actually came to my mind, what's the point in this? Why keep on, you know, dividing it up more and more? So here, perhaps the question is appropriate of the suitability of the, you know, what's the purpose of it?
Okay, what is the purpose of breaking up the step?
Beyond 3.
Yeah,
you know, 3, into... well, that's very natural.
You know, I can mention like at least two purposes. One is that it forces one to be really mindful of what is taking place, to have extraordinary consistency of mindfulness, because you know, even if one is doing 3 steps, 3 phases to each step, picking, pushing, putting, at the micro level, there's still scope within those 3 phases for the mind to be quickly drifting and coming back, drifting and coming back. But when you have to be mindful of, there's actually 6 physical, in the 12 phases, one has to be mindful of, the step is divided into 6 phases, 6 physical phases, but for each phase one has to be mindful of the intention that immediately precedes that action. So when one has to be mindful of these 12 phases within one step, it's a little bit like, did you ever see these tightrope walkers in a circus? Or especially the tightrope walker when there's no net underneath. A few years ago, some of us, we went to Niagara Falls for a little break, and one evening when I looked out my hotel room, there was a man on a tightrope walking from one hotel on this side of the street all the way to the top of the hotel that I was staying in, that we were staying in. And I was looking up, and from my room there was an illusion, an optical illusion of the tightrope going up this way. So it seemed like he was not only walking across the tightrope, but going upward. But that was an illusion. We went down to the street, and then we looked up, and the tightrope was actually just parallel to the ground. But this man had to be mindful of every phase and every step, otherwise down something like 50 stories maybe, there was no net down below. And it turned out this was not just a practical stunt done by a tourist, but this man, his name is, we found out, was Jay Cochran, and he's known as the Prince of Skywalking. That was to be his last year of skywalking. But at the time, he was like the foremost skywalker in the world. And in China, he had walked across the Yangtze River, doing skywalking across the Yangtze River. But we were thinking, wow, with that ability. Bo Wei was there. She was saying to me, introduce him to Buddhism. Introduce him to Buddhism. In no time, he'll become a stream enter. Yeah, so coming back to Donna's question, so one benefit is that one has to be really consistently mindful, because if the mind drifts, one loses, you know, if one is, say, in the ninth phase of the 12 phases and the mind drifts, and one wonders, what phase was I at? And then one has to start again from one. Okay, so the first benefit is consistency of mindfulness. And then the second benefit is that one is now seeing the impermanence within a single step. That, you know, it's not just that the step is impermanent and that the right step, follows the right, follows the left. Not only that phase one is followed by phase two, is followed by three, but now one is seeing that within a single step, there's a succession of at least six physical phases and six intentions that are arising and passing away. And so it brings one very quickly into the insight into impermanence. But to be able to practice that effectively, one doesn't begin immediately with that. Otherwise, the mind just gets lost and entangled in, you know, too much mental noting. But to be able to actually focus upon the physical process of walking, one has to build up to it gradually by going from first one step by step to three phases, then to the six phases in the physical step, then to 12 phases by noting the alternation of intention and action. Okay, let's take you first. What is your name?
Dave,
okay. And then Richard.
My question was to understand the purpose of an action. So sometimes it's not possible because some actions have far-reaching consequences.
Have
a long-term consequences.
For
example, my coming here, I'm not sure what is the consequence.
Right.
How can someone understand the purpose so easily?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, like, if you're trying to understand the purpose, what about the long-term consequences? Because many actions have consequences that one can't foresee. Yeah, of course one can't be responsible for consequences that one can't foresee, but one has to, within, let's say, the range of knowledge that one does have available, well, let's say probabilities, likelihood of what's to happen, that one has to take account of. But there are, you know, factors that we can never foresee. So I might have, for example, well, I don't want to take myself, but say, excuse me. It's just a story that occurred to me. This goes back, I think, something like the 12th or 15th century. Okay, there was a group of monks from Sri Lanka who were sent to Burma. I don't remember whether it was to renew the ordination or to teach the Dharma and Vinaya. And so they selected a group of very learned Sri Lankan monks. One of them was a master of the Vinaya, the monastic discipline. And so he was sent to Burma along with some other monks. I think his role was to teach the Vinaya, monastic discipline. So when he accepted that invitation, of course, his purpose was a very worthy one of helping to strengthen or revive the Dharma in Burma. But when they arrived, there was like a procession to greet them and welcome them. And there was a very elegant Burmese dancing girl who was part of the procession. I guess the Burmese dancing is very elegant, very sensuous. And so as the Vinaya master was walking in the procession and she was dancing ahead of him, he would have had his ceremonial fan in front of him. He looked up and he saw the dancing girl. And there must have been some karmic connection maybe from previous lives. But as soon as he saw her, his heart was stricken with love for her. I don't know the details, but when I imagine it in my mind's eye, after the ceremony is over, he asked one of the Burmese attendants, "How can I meet that dancing girl?" And the long and short of it is that he decided to give up the monastic life and he wound up marrying that dancing girl. I see Jen is eating her head. I mean, these things happen. That's the nature of life. You know, so this was like an extreme case of a consequence utterly unforeseen. You know, a worthy purpose to help strengthen or even revive the ordination in Burma, and then things turn out differently. Richard had...
Going back to Jay Cochran, the Skywalker, to me that points up a difference between noting things consciously as in naming them, which is how the text seems to read often, that mindfulness is the naming of each thing that you're doing, versus mindfulness, because Jay Cochran presumably is not naming each action to himself. That he's concentrating so hard on his walking that he probably doesn't have the energy to name what he's doing. Doing it with a completely, I would assume, doing it with a blank mind. He's just conscious of his body and his balance, right? And I'm wondering, what is the relationship between naming or noting, that is, noting in the sense of naming, and noting in the sense of being mindful? Because it doesn't seem to me that there's a necessary connection. Why to the text,
yeah,
often sound as if they're identical, as if naming the action is being mindful of the action.
Okay. Actually, there's at least two questions in that. I'll take them separately.
Okay.
First, the first point you brought up is actually very good and very true, that there is definitely a difference between the kind of mindfulness that Jay Cochran would be applying to walk across that tightrope, to do the skywalking from one building to another, and the kind of the way a monk, a meditating monk, would be practicing mindfulness according to that technique of dividing the step up into minute phases. So a skywalker will not be dividing the step up into phases, because if one does that, one is going to lose the kind of mindfulness that one needs to preserve one's balance. And so I brought up that example not to show that, I didn't intend to say that the skywalker is breaking each step up into minute phases, but to show that, to illustrate to give an example of somebody who has to maintain extreme consistency of mindfulness throughout an entire process. Okay, so that is the first point, that there is definitely a difference between maintaining what I would call a bare mindfulness and an analytical or discriminating mindfulness. And even in some approaches to the practice of walking meditation, they won't use the division of the step into minute phases, but some will teach just to be mindful of, continuously mindful of the act of walking, not using these mental notations, not dividing the step, but just being consistently aware of each step through each of these, well, being consistently aware of each step. As continuously as possible. Okay, so that is the answer to the first question. The second question is, why do the texts explain or formulate each of these processes as if one is making a mental note? And I think I would say that the text is not necessarily recommending making the mental note when performing each of these actions. That might be a kind of interpretation of the text which has arisen in contemporary Burma, or at least maybe Burma, the late 19th century, and then continuing on into the 20th century with the meditation teachers like Mahasi Soyador and his students, who are now prominent teachers, like Upandita, Ujjanaka. But the way, because the Buddhist texts come from an oral tradition, the way they would formulate almost any idea in which an agent is involved is not by saying that X will do A, B, and C while being aware of doing A, B, and C, but they'll say that when X does A, he knows I'm doing A. When he's doing B, he knows I am doing B. When doing C, he knows I am doing C. So that's just the way in which, in an oral tradition, the text will formulate the undertaking of an action while being aware of undertaking that action. Similarly, even when a narrative is describing that somebody has a particular thought, they won't say, let's say, Vayama the Brahmin had the thought that he should go see the Blessed One. But rather the text will say, then to the Brahmin Vayama the thought arose, let me go see the Blessed One. You know, so it's always put in the form of, you know, if we were a little bit like the comic books, we'll have all of the characters in the comic books will have, when they're thinking, they'll have the bubble coming out from the head with the thought enclosed in the bubble. So in oral traditions, or at least in the Buddhist oral tradition, thoughts are put in that way, as direct quotations, the agent thinking something to himself.
Can I ask one related question? Why is mindfulness thought to pertain more to one's actions than to one's perceptions? For instance, if I think of the concentration of a tracker,
the microphone is making a static sound which breaks up the words. Maybe
if I think of the concentration of a tracker, someone who is trailing an animal, and is noticing things like a tuft of fur on a branch and things like that.
Yeah.
This takes a great deal of concentration.
Yeah.
But it's a concentration directed outside oneself, in which one is perceiving things that have their own existence independent of one's actions.
Yeah.
Say, how would you be mindful in that sense? Would you be listening to bird call, right? Or would you be naming each thing that you're perceiving as opposed to each thing that you're doing on the assumption that a perception is an action or is a kind of action?
Okay.
It's complicated that way, because if you did that, you then have to think a lot more about what it is you're naming, whereas in a routine action, where say you're describing your walking to yourself, right? You know what's coming next. Like if you decided to divide steps up into 12 steps, you know what's coming next. Whereas if you were doing it with perceptions, you wouldn't know, because they're given to you rather than being part of your action, right? And so it's naming will be a more complicated process. But is that kind of thing, like the action of a tracker or a bird watcher, is that considered mindfulness or not? Mindfulness, why not?
That seems to me more of a refined perception rather than mindfulness. Because mindfulness it's difficult to answer. But it seems to me to be, as I said, a more refined or a more precise mode of perception. Okay, mindfulness, the original word which we translate as mindfulness is sati, in Pali it's sati, and the original meaning of sati is recollection, remembering. And so that is the meaning that the word takes in ordinary discourse, and even in some places in the early Buddhist texts, sati is used in that sense, of remembering what had been done and said long ago. But now the Buddha took this word from ordinary usage and gave it a different nuance, so that mindfulness or sati is not remembering the past, but retaining in mind the present, keeping in mind what is occurring in the present. And so it involves what I would call a degree of reflexivity. That's reflection, not R-E-F-L-E-C-T-I-O-N, but R-E-F-L-E-X-I-O-N. That is a sort of bending back. I call it the bending back of the beam of awareness upon oneself, so that one is aware of what one is either doing, feeling, thinking, and it can also apply to what one is perceiving, but the focus, because it has that reflexive aspect, the focus will be on the act of perception rather than on the object of perception.
The use of mind in this is very much like the Victorian usage when children were told to mind their manners.
Yeah.
Like the mind, the sense that mind takes on in that in these phrases. Is like that Victorian usage. I'm wondering whether the Victorian usage actually came from India.
Came from India?
Yeah, because the British were ruling India. They'd been ruling India for more than 250 years.
Yeah.
When the Victorians started to use that idiom.
I think it was Victorian, the late Victorian translators of Buddhist texts who might have introduced mindfulness as a rendering for sati. Though I think Rhys Davids, who was the first of the, or at least the most prominent of the early British translators, I think had attentiveness or attention for sati. I don't know who introduced mindfulness, but once mindfulness...
So then probably it was the translators who introduced that. And they may have done it because the idiom already existed in the Victorian English. As many of the translators would have, they'd have gone to college in Britain, right? In Oxford and Cambridge, primarily. And Oxford and Cambridge were the primary sources of the intellectuals for the British East India Trading Company, like the Mills, James Mill, and John Stuart Mill, wrote enormous amounts for the British East India Company.
I know that a few years ago, when I used to use a spelling checker on my Word documents, it would always highlight the word mindfulness like it was a word that was not in the dictionary. Mindful, it would skip over mindful, since mindful would have been an accepted word. But it would stop at mindfulness, you know, to query, is this the correct word you want? Now I think over the last 5 years there's been such a explosion of mindfulness trainings, mindfulness and mindfulness in the military, mindfulness in education, mindfulness, the art of mindful cooking, the art of mindful pregnancy, the art of mindful childbearing, the art of
mindful sex.
Mindful. Somebody told me, I don't know whether this is true. Even McDonald's is promoting eating a Big Mac mindfully. Is that true?
A happy meal mindfully for your children.
Mindful inattention.
Screwing everything up mindfully. The art of mindful swimming, mindful... Oh, yeah. I know the woman who wrote this, the mindful gardener. Suki?
Maybe my thoughts on that topic, naming thing and then also the sati.
Yeah, please.
The word pajanati and sanjanati, knowing, directly knowing.
Yeah.
Directly, so So when we have a meditation,
yeah,
I kind of see like two tiers of knowing.
Yeah.
The outer tier is more like perception, or when you're not into the second beyond discursive thinking tier, I mean beyond that, at the beginning you have a more perceiving things, and naming it also belongs there because it has something to do with your thoughts.
Yeah.
But when you go a little further, you have it's knowing without like a discursive thinking. So I feel there's like a...
Okay, so in other words, if I understand you, you're saying that one uses the noting at the early phase in order to keep the mind on the object, so that the mind doesn't wander.
Right, right.
But then once the mindfulness and concentration builds up strength,
right,
then one could drop the noting,
right,
and just observe directly what's happening.
Right. So what we experience is when we know the meditation object more clearly, also at the same time, thoughts arise, then you know. So it happens, there's a knowing, what you call, space, and then thought space, separate. You see two things there.
Yeah.
So, sati, I mean, there are two different tiers of sati, but here, real mindfulness of breathing or what, in meditation, it's a knowing.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I think there is a separation there. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, if I understand you correctly, what you say is valid. That in the early phase, one will use a mental noting in order to ensure that one is keeping track of the object and not letting the mind, you know, wander without being aware of it. But once the power, once the mindfulness and concentration pick up power and consistency, then one could drop the mental noting and just focus on the direct experience itself without using mental notes.
Right, and I think the practitioner should go beyond mental noting.
Yeah.
Drop it and go further.
Yeah.
To actually see.
Yeah, I mean, definitely that's the case, yeah. Okay, I think Jen has some comment.
Could it be like two types of meditation? One is like single point, the one noting what's going on, was object oriented, and the other type is like object less. So that all object.
Without a fixed object.
Yeah.
I mean, within the tradition that that I've learned, there should always be like what we call a root object or an anchor object, so that one doesn't just, you know, drop all objects altogether, but one has a root object that one returns to when there's nothing else is particularly prominent. But then when something else comes into the field of awareness, then one notes it.
So maintain the pure awareness, just the awareness.
Without any object. In my understanding, awareness will always have an object, but there are some meditative states in which the mind is focused back upon itself, so one is aware of the mind rather than an external object. In that case, the object is the mind, and the observer is the mind. So it's the mind observing the mind. But at least within my own experience, one has to keep a kind of secondary noting going on in the background, that one is aware of the mind. Otherwise, the mind will drift away from the mind and get sort of swept up by extraneous thoughts that arise. Barbara?
Kind of small question, but you mentioned that, of course, there is a difference between deep meditation and sleep.
Yeah.
How do we discriminate? Is it sometimes, what can we do if we think we were still meditating, but maybe we were sleeping? How does one do that?
I think through introspection, one just pretty much knows whether the mind is drowsy. One could tell whether the awareness is getting sort of out of focus and the mind is getting heavy, dull, and cloudy. Then there's a tendency to sort of drop into a sleep state, even momentarily. But then one is aware that it's within that state, or one knows that within that state, the awareness is not clear and sharp, but it's just vanished, the awareness has vanished. Whereas within a deep state of meditative absorption, the awareness would be clear and bright, that there's not a loss of awareness. Okay, it's 11:20 now, so we'll have to stop now. Yeah, I was hoping to take the bodily parts meditation, but we missed. But we'll come back to this. Next week, we won't have the class, because next week we have the Abhidhamma retreat. And if any of you are interested in the Abhidhamma, you're supposed to be interested. Please register. I think you can register either online or at the Zhuangyan Monastery office. And another thing I should mention, okay, we will have the next sutta class will be the Saturday after that. This will be the 6th, September 6th. Another thing I want to mention is that on Sunday, September 21st, there will take place in New York City what is called the People's Climate March. And this is supposed to be the largest climate march in history. And the purpose for this, or the reason why it's being held on this date, is that the following week at the United Nations, there will be a major conference taking place of world leaders to discuss the climate crisis, which is now really spiraling out of control to the detriment of, say, quite literally, of human civilization. The glaciers are melting at twice the expected rate, and if things continue along this trajectory, there'll be many just terrible disasters ahead. We already are experiencing a taste of that. Carolyn told me yesterday that just 2 days ago, that there was, or 2 nights ago, there was flooding in Port Jervis, just north of here, and homes were going underwater. And this is just a foretaste of what lies ahead. So as human beings, especially as people living in America, who the country that has the most responsibility for the carbon emissions, we have to start reversing the process of uncontrolled carbon emissions. And so there will be a People's Climate March in New York City on September 21st. People are coming from across the United States, even other countries, other continents. A number of Buddhist groups will be participating in this march, including Buddhist Global Relief, and I'll be joining that march. And so if anybody, well, first I encourage those who are free to join the march, And you can join our Buddhist Global Relief section if you wish to. If you go to the Buddhist Global Relief website, or actually it's on the Facebook page, there's the New York Buddhist Global Relief New York City section. It's called Compassionate CAC. Anyway, if you're interested in joining the Buddhist Global Relief section, you could just inform me, let me know. And then I will let you know when we have the details of where we're going to be meeting. I think the march will be on Sunday, September 21st. I think it will start at 12 noon and then continue, go for about 2 hours, 2 or 3 hours. Not all walking, there'll be speeches. Excuse me?
I'm interested.
Okay. Then you just give me your email address, and when I know the details, I will let you know. CAC. You could also look on Facebook. Just look at Buddhist Global Relief.
CAC traditionally would be Climate Action Coalition.
No, no, this is something. I know the first part is Compassionate Action.
Coalition?
Could it be Coalition? It's the New York City group of Buddhist Global Relief have created that Facebook page. I saw it last evening, but now I forgot what the second C stands for. Bad memory.
Monday, the 21st of September, also coincides with International Day of Peace. The International Day of Peace is on 21st of September also.
Oh, I see. International
Day of Peace is also on 21st.
Yeah. Okay, so let us then end for the day with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, the fear spirits, the dragon spirits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga hedika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. I think the CAC, it could be Compassionate Action Community. That's what it is, Compassionate Action Community. And that has, on that Facebook page, there is a, we call it a link, through which that'll take you to another page where you could register to join the march.
Anybody is leaving from Ulster County, there's a bus available through the New Paltz Climate Action Coalition.
From New Paltz?
Yes.
That's from Ulster County.
Right.
Ulster is on the western side of the Hudson.
And as far as I've been told, there are still seats available.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we end with three half bows to Buddha. And we'll come back at, let's say, 12:30. We could have half an hour of discussion.
About the bathing.